Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. We're here until 9 o'clock, and this being the Sunday night, we have someone in picking the music. And tonight, with the inevitable song introduction, my guest is the actor Eileen Walsh. Eileen, every time I have an actor, actress in here, I ask the question, is it actor or actress?
Well, I don't care.
That's all right.
It doesn't really bother me.
We'll move. As soon as I said actor, I thought, oh God, last time I said that.
Well, I immediately say actor.
Right.
And then I was auditioning once for Mike Lee, and he said, so, you know, tell me about yourself. And I said, well, my sister's also an actress. And he said, oh, see what you did there? She's an actress, but you're an actor. I was like, oh, I didn't think I was that much of, oh, God.
And so, there's no clearly defined method in that anymore. It doesn't matter.
No, exactly.
Good, good.
Yeah.
Your sister is an actor.
An actor, actress.
An actor, actress. Catherine Walsh.
Yeah.
Very well known, very well respected. So can we go back then to the house in Cork? Whereabouts in Cork were you from?
Quaker Road.
Right.
Right in the city centre.
Yeah.
Quite close to Turner's Cross.
Right.
Our house was opposite Murphy's Evergreen Bacon Factory. So a pig slaughterhouse.
Really?
Yeah.
Did that haunt your childhood?
Yeah. But like in a very positive way, if pig slaughterhouse could be, you know, positive. I remember our bedroom window looking over the massive green gate. And every day you would hear all the little bonnives screeching.
Oh.
And then by midday, silence. And then the lads would come out in their white butcher coats covered in blood for their fag and wave across over the green metal gate that, because you'd be hanging out the window waving at them.
Oh.
And then they used to let the blood run down the street.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like Angela's Ashes.
Angela's
Asses. That's a movie.
I remember the abattoir at home too. You know, you passed it every day and you would see things you weren't supposed to see and hear things you weren't supposed to hear.
But then also, you know, my mum would send us up to the shop to get sausages. And I never connected the squealing piggies, the blood running down the street and the sausages stuffing my face. Like,
so there you are beside the bacon bacon factory, bacon killing place, and near Turner's Cross.
Mm.
What did your folks do?
So my dad was, I always got this wrong. I used to call him a builder's labourer and he was so annoyed at me because he used to drive, like he was a JCB driver.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to get that wrong as well. But yeah, he worked for Doyle's, which were down on the in the Keys. And he worked very, very hard. He would get up at like, you know, 6 and light the fire downstairs so that the kitchen was warm for us all to come into. That was done. And then he'd head out the door to work and we wouldn't see him until 6 or 7 o'clock at night, where he would come back. And, you know, he used to go in with the JCB into the bowels of the ship to empty it out of animal feed or coal or whatever had come in that day. And he would come home covered in the dust of the animal feed, like eyeliner. It was in everywhere in him. I just remember thinking he always worked very, very hard. Yeah.
And
my mum was, she used to work in Singer's sewing factory.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as was the rule, once you were married, you had to give up your job. So she was our stay-at-home mum.
And was there anything in your parents that led to, well, as far as I know, at least two of their offspring becoming people of the stage?
Not, like, when we were growing up, our aunt was a great writer and she loved writing poetry and writing her own plays, and that Frances was very prolific. And there was always sing songs in the house, that kind of thing. But nothing other that most families would have done, I think, really. But my mum has since, you know, joined numerous kind of singing groups. And so there's obviously a history of that within it, you know, but nothing really acting wise.
First musical choice, Eileen, is what?
Yeah.
You can start wherever you like. Finley Quay is the first name down there.
Yeah.
That's cool. I remember when he came out, what was he? Was Tricky's nephew or something.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So this for me is all kind of linked in with Disco Pigs, Edinburgh, meeting my now husband. And this played the night that we kind of got together for the first time, which was the night Lady Diana died. So
there we are.
Yeah, that's a lot whole of connection there.
A lot of information in that introduction. Here it comes. And that's Finlay Quay and a track called Even After All. The first choice of my guest tonight is Eileen Walsh, who will be performing at the Gate Theatre this week, actually. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. Eileen, just before, you mentioned that Disco Pigs and all the rest of it, and that was the period where you met your husband and all of that. That's a long time ago think about it. When was that now?
Well, so last year, I think it was, Disco Pigs had its like 20th anniversary.
Wow.
21st or something like that. Like, it's it really is a long time ago.
And what are your memories of that now? Because it was, Killian was in here doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. as was Enda. Mm-hmm. Seems to have been a very, very intense kind of a period. It was like a band suddenly becoming huge overnight.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen very often with a play.
No. And I think as well, being like 18, 17, about 18, I think, you expect all plays to be like that.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, everything is successful and fabulous and it really was, as weird as it sounds, kind of that long, hot summer vibe, you know, because we were all growing at the same time. We were all kind of going out and discovering little tiny European cities and having a ball. And nobody was tied down, you know, nobody was worried about bills or mortgage or anything. And it was just about the play.
But you were kind of like the Beatles or something. Do you know?
Obviously, I know, there was a funny thing.
Not on that scale, obviously. But what I mean is the intensity of it was as I said, with plays, that doesn't really happen, that it sort of catches in that way.
Yeah. And I think, like, I still have people. I went in for a film audition thing just recently and a casting agent said to me, oh, I have to say, I was one of the lucky ones that saw it in the bush.
Wow.
So they still feel like that they were one of the lucky ones to get into the small venue. You know, it's like the people who can say here that they saw it in the International Bar, because that was like standing room only nearly at one point for like 30 people or something ridiculous.
Did you come out and know her at that point, Eileen? Had you done any acting
before?
So
I had done, do you know Gina Moxley?
Yeah.
So Gina wrote her first play called Dan to Dan, and I was 17 and I did that with Rough Magic.
Right.
And then Enda saw that and then approached me about Disco Pigs, but I had just started Trinity. So my first summer off with Trinity, I went down to Cork and started Disco Pigs.
Because I think Killian just sort of rocked up and looked for a part,
didn't he? Killian
was
doing law in UCC.
Yeah.
And I know his poor parents, I think, were like, please don't leave. Please don't leave. What are you doing? And then he was really close to getting offered a record deal with the band.
Sons of Mr. Green Jeans.
Like, just, it was a time where it felt like this is the only option. Of like, what? Who would turn that down? You know, and it did feel like a family. You know,
it's brilliant though that that happened to you when you were young. You know,
yeah.
You know, at a time where you could really just embrace,
have an amazing experience,
and discover the world in that way.
And it's one of the things that I would be most proud of, that our friendship still holds up, and that I've gone back and worked with both Enda and Corkadorka with Pat Kiernan, you know, numerous times, and that thrills me. That the relationship continues, you know.
So you had a big sister who was an actor, right? Catherine. And you had done this play with Gina Moxley. Do you remember in your case, Eileen, what it was that first sparked the notion of having a lash at this acting business?
Catherine started acting school. She came up into Trinity and but when she started, it was a time when you had to have your equity card. So you had to work backstage for a year. You had to go buy props, or you had to do something to get your stamps nearly to get your equity card. I remember thinking, oh, it's so hard. It's so hard. And then she did Road by Jim Cartwright for her graduation show. And my poor mother saw it, and my mother was like, "Ah, you're playing a prostitute," and oh, you know, it really was a terrible birth by fire from my mother into acting. I just thought, God, it's so exciting. I wasn't allowed to go and see Road, so her boyfriend at the time, George, took me to see Uncle Buck. And I'm thinking, oh, this is so awful. I want to see the drama of it. But I was doing Saturday morning workshops and all that. I just remember feeling like it's the only thing I'm good at. I know I'm good at it. I never knew I was good at it. I enjoyed English, but I never knew with confidence as well as I knew I could lose myself in acting. So there was never a question as that it wouldn't work out for me. Of course it would, because this is what I'm good at. Now, that confidence, you then try and get back for the rest of your life. Do you know what I mean? I don't have that confidence now. Yeah. I don't know if I'm good at it, but it's something that I have in me.
Next musical choice. Mm-hmm. Now, this suggests an era where you might have been out on the town enjoying yourself.
There's also, well, so there's a beautiful track of, oddly enough, Coldplay, live in concert, playing Fight for Your Right, a cover version for when one of the lads, one of the Beastie Boys died.
Yeah.
And it is such a beautiful piece. So anyway, I thought I'd put this in because I like nothing more than losing myself in this track at home.
Yeah!
Fight for Your Right, Beastie Boys, the second choice tonight from our guest Eileen Walsh, who's with me in the studio. Eileen, you were talking about getting those early parts, and that acting was the only thing you knew you could do. What kind of personality did you have as a teenager? Because sometimes I talk to actors and they always say, "Oh, I was shy, I was awkward, I was all these things, but acting was the only thing I could do."
Yeah.
But were you kind of socially awkward or inept or any of those things?
Yeah, I guess I was really. I'm the youngest of six, so the house was always busy, but I didn't have that many friends growing up, mainly because my sisters and my brother, they all had the kids in the area. And then by the time I came along, there wasn't as many kids in the area. I don't remember there being loads of friends. I was friends with Emma Dewan, who was the butcher's daughter at the top of the road. And we used to hang out in the butcher shop when her dad would go in for a pint and play with the meat.
Okay.
No, you know, that's sad. But great crack. And but I loved English. My sister's Mary is an English teacher, and she was very kind of encouraging and nurturing of that. So I used to write a lot of poetry, a lot of essays, just off my own back. And then that's what led into more drama, because I thought that poetry was always about AIDS and cancer and dying, because the AIDS quilt was huge at the time. So it was always about death and dying and that bleeding into pianos. That was another great theme of mine. Great.
Okay.
Acting for me was another way of making it depressing for myself, I suppose. And then one day a sub teacher came in and had us do washing machines. I was like, that's not drama. Drama's AIDS and all that. And then I laughed so much with being a washing machine. And I thought, oh my God, there's a whole lighter side that you forget about. And
so you had to pretend to be a washing machine?
Yeah.
Spin cycle.
Spin cycle. Yes, we just jumped on the floor, basically. There was a lot of that.
Very good.
Transcendental meditation.
I'd commission that if I was if I had the authority. It just often strikes me. So many actors tell me that they were very shy, and then I can't help thinking it seems to be the last thing you would do if you were shy is put yourself up on a stage.
I mean, don't remember being shy though, right. And I think because of being the youngest of six, you had to be pretty loud to get heard. And I was very young, and I remember my brother would often tell stories about me making up jokes just to be part of the grown-up conversation. Things like, you know, why did the Kerry man fall out the window? Because, you know, he was ironing his curtains. Like, I thought that was hilarious. But I love making older people laugh. But it was anything just to be allowed into the centre of it.
And you weren't, to invoke another stereotype about actors, you weren't what you would call a show-off, were you?
No.
No.
No. Yeah, because it's interesting when people see kids be show-off, they always like flick your leg and go, oh, another actor.
That's right.
They're like, really? Yeah. That's not the kid that's going to be the actor.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah.
It's that kid over there who's pinned against a wall crying. That's the one.
Bleeding into the piano.
Yeah. All
right. Your next choice is Maya Angelou. Okay. Oh. Right. Yeah, well, what can you say about Maya Angelou?
Well, so Stuart and I, have two girls, Tippi and Ethel. And I quote this to them all the time. I'm like, does my sassiness upset you? I love it. And I love the fact of the ownership of your body and the pride in what you have and what you bring to a room. And particularly girls can be quite nasty with each other and quite attacking of each other. And even when they're little, like Tippi's 13, Ethel's 10, and I still will... they'll still need to be reminded that it's okay. You know, you got to come up. You got to rise above it sometimes. You know, I love it and I love her voice.
You may write me down.
Maya Angelou, that's some voice, Eileen, isn't it?
It
really is. And you say you play that to your kids.
I do.
Yeah.
It makes me proud to be a woman, that hearing her voice.
She's quite something, all right, Maya Angelou. You just mentioned in passing that one of your kids is called Tippi.
Yeah.
Is that Tippi Hedren? Or
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Sure. I was very heavily pregnant and saw the end of the Birds film, weirdly. And I would never... I hate pigeons. I hate scary movies. I don't know what happened. But anyway, I caught the credits as they were going. I thought, oh, Tippi. Stuart's name is McCaffrey. It's such a strong Scottish name. I thought, Tippi, that's amazing. And she spells it T-I-P-P-I. So I thought that's a bit American. So it's just T-I-P-P-Y.
And where did Ethel come from then?
So, hilariously, Ethel was born in South London. Stuart got accepted into the Royal College of Art. We moved down when I was about 15 months pregnant, is what it felt like at the time. And we lived in an apartment. Ethel was born. I thought, oh my God, I don't know where this name has come from. This is a beautiful old granny name. She must be called Ethel. And then we went home, and a couple of days later or whatever, I was up and I was opening the curtains of the flat, and I noticed that we lived directly across the road from South London's biggest housing estate. That's called the Ethel Brewer housing estate.
There we are.
So poor Tippi's called after the actor and Ethel's called after a housing estate in South London.
Terrific.
Thankfully, there's also an Ethel Merman that we
there is, yes, yeah,
refer to.
And so are any sign of them acting?
Yeah, Tippi loves it, and Tippi loves singing. Ethel loves dancing, you know, but I'm hoping...
Would you encourage that or discourage
John.
It?
Jesus, no, would you?
No, absolutely not.
No. I want them to be a plumber and a plasterer.
Yeah.
Like I'd fight it. It's hard. It's a hard life. And
but they won't listen to you, that's the other thing.
No, damn them, they won't.
No, but even though you know what you're talking about, and you literally know what you're talking about in that case. I know we pretend that we know things about other things, but in this case you know about acting.
Yeah.
But they won't listen.
No, but I wouldn't have listened either.
No.
So I guess I just got to roll with that a bit. And thankfully, I met Stuart and he was a barber. So his thing is that once they turn 15, he wants to just teach them to cut hair. So he's like, as long as they can cut hair, they can travel, they can do anything, everyone's always going to need a haircut.
Very true.
So you think, okay, then they'll got something, you know, they'll have something under their belt, as my poor mum would say.
Yeah. So you're certainly not going to be pushing them towards the theatre.
No. It's too hard.
What actual training did you get then, and where did you get that?
I was one of the final I did 2 years in Trinity, which was a diploma in theatre studies. You could do Andrew Scott was doing the 4 year at the same time, and then he dropped out to become massively successful. But 2 years was the most I could have done. I loved it and really enjoyed it, but I was desperate to be working. And then obviously with Disco Pigs in the middle of it, I didn't even make my graduation.
Mm.
Like I finished, but I wasn't free. I was off on tour with Disco Pigs for the graduation. So, you know, I was just ready. Like the traps had opened.
You know, it's again, it's probably not the advice you give your kids, but you kind of have to do that when the chance comes along, don't you?
Yeah.
You got to do it.
Totally.
I mean, the parent in you would probably be saying to your kids, well, finish your course first and then you can do it you like.
Well, I did. I did finish it and I was lucky that, you know, they allowed me to do Disco Pigs, particularly Dublin Festival, I think, is the beginning of college term as well. So I actually had to kind of do my college and then go up and do the international bar and then come back and finish college. Every day when the festival was on.
Mm.
But, you know, they kind of stretched the rules to allow me to do that because you weren't supposed to work. But, you know, nobody was going to tell me not to. I think I would have left anyway.
We haven't talked, actually, about what music you were listening to when you... Oh, I got an idea of it there. But when you were a kid, though, what were you listening to? What was on in the house?
So my dad loved listening to the radio. So there was always Irish songs and fiddly-diddly-dees going on. But he loved singing along in the car. And they would make us sing in the car too, you know, that kind of thing. So I do remember that. And then my uncle, Willie, was a great man for whenever there'd be a party at the house. He'd start an El Sing song.
What was his party piece, do you remember?
God, no, I can't remember.
Would these have been... Camellias, or would they have been, you know, country and western ballads?
No, it would have been camellias, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then as I grew older, I became friends with this girl called Elizabeth Begley, who I adored. She was like my first proper girlfriend that we did everything together. And she loved R.E.M. So therefore, I loved R.E.M.
Yeah.
And I could never be quite as cool as her. She was always so beautiful. She shaved her head and she looked like a more beautiful version than Sinead O'Connor. And then I thought, oh, sure, I'll shave my head. It was so sad. So R.E.M. became massive to us. We would be primed at the hit record button on MTV, waiting for the new video to come out and screaming, just Begley and I in my living room, my poor mum again with her fingers in her ears.
R.E.M.'s not on your list?
I have further down, look, with Michael Stipe.
Oh, and Natalie Merchant.
Yeah.
Will we play that now?
Yeah, why not?
Where did this come from? This is To Sir With Love. That's Lulu,
so
isn't it?
It's from the movie, but I just remember it was one of the things that he, they did a live performance. Was it MTV Awards or something like that? It was one of the things that we were recording everything that they ever existed and did. And I just love the song.
Okay, here it comes. Yeah. To Sir With Love with Michael Stipe, Natalie Merchant there. Eileen Walsh is my guest tonight, picking all the music. Eileen, just as that was playing through, it's become evident to me you really were a serious R.E.M. fan.
Yeah.
Still are.
Yeah.
Massive.
Yeah. Because I was just saying that my lovely friend, Begley, her uncle was Joe Herlihy, and Joe got the amazing gig. So Joe used to work for, he was sound engineer for U2, and then when R.E.M. came to do their... concert at Slane, Joe got the gig and we were inconsolable with excitement because Joe got us VIP tickets and Begley got to meet them, actually.
Only Begley got to meet them,
in fairness.
Oh dear.
Yeah, well, we hung out backstage to try and meet them, but I'd say,
well, you did your best.
They probably avoided the two screaming
they probably heard
girls
all about you in advance. Were you part of any other kind of musical tribe growing up? I mean, you're obviously an R.E.M. fan, but were you ever, for instance, a goth or a punk?
Not really. I just was so not cool, John, to be honest. Like, Begley was cool and she knew Stiff Little Fingers and everything, and I kind of pretended to. But I didn't, you know. And
but that's okay. I mean, it usually is an affectation. So did you even affect anything?
I mean, you know, I was really good at dancing.
Yeah.
So that was fine. And then sure, fellas wouldn't come anywhere near me because I was next to Begley. They all wanted Begley, so, you know. And so I would just dance. That's grand.
Sounds like you want to talk about this a lot.
John, I could talk about this for hours.
This Begley situation.
Adore Begley. I think I was in love with her. But who did that song? Oh. Blister in the Sun.
Blister in the Sun. Violent Femmes.
Ah.
Violent Femmes. They were very niche. Kind of
yeah,
cult.
Well, cult. You know, Begley John. She loved them. I just love that song.
I like the sound of this Begley one
yeah,
myself.
I know. Look, everyone loved her.
Well, I suppose if a girl had a cassette tape with the Violent Femmes on it.
Yeah, and she was stunning.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm over it now, John. Let's move
I'm
on.
I'm not sure I am, but there we are. Okay, so your next choice, Eileen, is what?
It Hurts So Good.
Ah, and this, listen, this comes, we've the version we've got of this is Susan Cadogan, yeah?
Yeah.
Reggae beat. Kevin Barry was in here one night doing what you're doing. He told me that Cork was the reggae capital of the world at one point.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I didn't believe him, but clearly there's a bit of dancehall and all the rest of it going on as well.
Oh, totally.
So were you out in the town in Cork at various... Because everybody from Cork tells me there's amazing places to go where you could dance.
Henry's.
Yeah.
Sir
and
Henry's.
Other places, yeah.
Yeah, Sir Henry's was the massive place. But, you know, I was really good. I was a really good girl. And it kind of scared me. And I never really did E. But I'd go and dance. And it was my 18th birthday and I still looked about 12, God love us. But I was with Begley, so I got in. And we got into Henry's. And it was so amazing. And I danced and danced and danced. I remember this guy coming over. And he ran his finger up my spine. And he was like, hey, you on a good one? And I was like, oh, I'm having a lovely time. So I lost loads of cool points, but just kept dancing. So that's kind of that was my drug fueled madness of
Your
being
mad
18.
And from that period, you want Susan Cadogan.
Yeah.
And Hurts So Good. Susan Cadogan there and Hurt So Good. The choice of Eileen Walsh is with me in studio at the moment, revealing all about growing up in Cork and all the rest of it. What was the first? Disco Pigs obviously was the first big one, I guess. After that, when you sort of, you know, did you then set your sights on, I'm definitely an actor now. I'm definitely an actor.
Well, one kind of tripped off the other, actually.
Yeah.
You just started working and, you know, you hadn't realised. So we had, Kill and I had agreed that we wouldn't do Disco Pigs without each other.
Right.
For some mad reason, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, we adored each other. But we had done it for 2 years, really, on and off.
Yeah.
And then we both got offered small films, and it seemed like the right time to just go, right, we're off now.
So you're well up for that then?
Yeah.
Quite ready for it?
Yeah, totally. Mm. And then it just started to, we both met our partners as well at that same time. So, you know, between travelling back up to Scotland to see Stuart and then auditioning in London or back to Dublin, and just work started.
And what about, you know, when did you first find yourself working with one of the big theatre companies here, you know, like Druid or the Abbey and that kind of thing? When did that start?
Well, I think because of Disco Pigs, what would have been my next? I can't really remember what my next thing would be, but Lynn Parker was always great because
Rough
Magic. She had done Dante Dan, yeah, initially. So I really felt like I had a home with Lynn to begin with, you know. And from there, so I went back and worked with Rough Magic. We did, I'm sure they won't mind me saying, Boomtown, the name that shall not be mentioned. That was bonkers piece in the centre of Temple Bar in a purpose-built theatre that was right in the centre. It was madness. But actually great crack to do. But then working with Gary and Druid, I worked with Gary on Marco Rose Terminus.
Right.
And I was petrified because it was Gary, it was Marie Mullen, it was Aisling O'Sullivan.
That's pretty serious.
Pretty serious.
The best of the best there.
Jesus,
you just listed
Joseph.
Them.
Yeah. And the Hines then. We ended up having a bit of a row. But it's no harm.
So was Gary Hines known to you as the Hines?
She is now.
Right. Okay.
I simply refer to her as the Hines. Yeah, we had a bit of a blazing row one day. And then it was great. Then you kind of have a bit more of equal footing. It's all right.
When you're a young actor like that coming in, even though Disco Pigs is huge and all the rest of it, I suppose you have to mind yourself and mind your manners and all that kind of stuff. Know your place as such.
Well, and you know absolutely. Yeah. And learn, you're still learning your craft. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But, and I obviously knew Marie and I obviously knew Aisling before, like, you know what I mean? I knew of them.
Yeah.
So to be watching them was kind of amazing. But I also valued my own weight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I loved being in the room with them, but I knew I could bring something to Tilly, to that character. And I trusted that. So it was no harm having a little bit of argy-bargy with the Hinds.
I suppose you have to be like that, don't you?
Yeah.
You can't be meek.
Yeah. Also, that's kind of what makes the job enjoyable. It's all right, you know, to know that you can come back from it.
Yeah.
And then with that Susan Cadogan track, I used to do lots of running. And that for me is the Geely concert, which I went back and did with Gary. And I was very lucky to actually have touched on some of Tom Murphy's plays with Gary and while Tom was around, you know, so.
And were you the kind of person, I assume all actors are like this, I assume they are, but would just be blown away to be getting to use Tom Murphy's words, use that language,
it
you know.
Was,
I mean, it's not just your, you know, it's not like you're handed a song sheet and go, here, go and sing that.
No.
You know?
It's something that would unpeel more the more Tom would come in as well, because he would sit there with his eyes closed and just listen to it being said. And he couldn't help it, but his arm would raise while his eyes were closed and he would conduct you.
Wow.
And you suddenly go, ah, because it's opera.
Yeah.
It's similar to Marina Carr, you know, it's these massive stories of these epic proportions on a dinner plate, on a tiny little suburban house. And I think that's what he did so beautifully. So getting to put those words in your mouth is kind of amazing. And sometimes he would say, he would add tiny little bits of description that would blow your mind, for me anyway. There's a scene in Conversations on Homecoming where the young girl, whose name I'm not going to think of, the young girl who works in the bar,
yeah.
Right? She kind of swings by and tots out the door. And Tom says, yes, it's as she walks, she swings her ponytail. She has that little and it's just divine little flirtation thing of walking out the door. So, yeah, I feel totally blessed that to have gotten the chance that Gary allowed me be part of Murphy's stuff.
And Gary's been on here on this programme doing what you're doing now, picking the music and so on. So she'll not mind me asking about how she works.
Mm.
I mean, does Gary, you know, cut you plenty of slack as an actor? Or
does she not?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
No.
No.
No, I think she, Gary very much has strong images in her mind and knows that that's what she wants to get to. And sometimes it can be very frustrating because she'll go, do the image, do the scene in with that image, whatever. And then you have to try and make it work and you're going, I don't understand why you want me in the doorway. And she's like, because it works. And then suddenly something will click and you go, ah, I get it. I got it now.
So she would be right?
Of course she's
yeah.
right. Of course she's right.
Yeah.
Until she's not right, and then I'm right, and then that's like winning the lottery. You know, when the writer or whatever would come in and go, oh, I like that, you go, oh, Gary, and that was my idea. Yeah.
How early on do you think you got to the point where you were doing exactly what you're talking about, where you were so open? Because I've seen you in loads of things where you look destroyed on the stage, you know.
Yeah.
It is literally tears,
yeah.
snot,
yeah.
everything.
Yeah.
You know, you're really
very attractive, John.
Very
Thanks.
Attractive.
Thanks. Yeah.
will you get to the end of this? But when you really have put yourself through the ringer.
Yeah.
How early on were you able to do that?
So I remember being on tour with Disco Pigs. We were in Toronto and it had kind of blown up. We were playing massive venues. And it is a bit like, you know, being a rock star, going from these tiny little pub venues to genuinely playing 1,500 seaters. And there's just these two faces that are responsible to project all this up. And I remember we were staying in a very fancy hotel and it just all got to me. because I kind of thought, I can't be responsible for that much money, those many faces. And weirdly, I remember swimming in the pool in the fancy hotel and sitting on the bottom of the pool and just thinking, I could just stay here and then nobody would know. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a bit dark. And then that night I had a panic attack on stage, which is the most awful thing.
What? How did that manifest itself? What happened?
So Disco Pigs was monologue, monologue, monologue. And then there'd be scenes together of madness. And so I was standing over by the edge of the pig pen. Kill was talking. And then I knew his monologue was coming to an end and I had to turn in and begin mine. And it was about the thing of, I think I was about to get into the fight or something like that. I knew I had to get to the fight, but I couldn't remember the starting line. And so as Killian was talking, it makes me feel sick even thinking about it. I could feel pins and needles in my face and my heart beating so fast because the line wasn't coming, you're not going to think. And I remember thinking, just walk off. Don't embarrass yourself because you're just going to turn around and throw up. I don't know what I was going to do. And I turned around and something came out. I don't know what it was, but the monologue started. And I'm thinking, I can't get to that stage again. I can't go back to that. I was very young and it was a very dark place. The fear of having to get up and do the show again the next night. So the cost can be big. I think since having kids, you can't allow it be as big, you know. Terminus was another one. I found it so hard to be on stage. We played the public in New York with that and I would cry on my way to work.
But this is subject matter you're talking about now, though, isn't it?
Well, it's for Terminus, it was the pressure of the rhyme, actually.
Mm.
You're
still talking about
happily,
the performance
yeah,
of it.
Totally.
Then. Yeah,
totally. I would happily lose myself in any of that. I loved the amazing writing that Mark O'Rourke has, but the fear of not being able to perform it to full capacity, I think, is what terrified me. And I would cry. I remember Sam Shepard came to see it in New York, and Fiac, who was running the Abbey at the time, Fiac introduced me to Sam Shepard, and I was like, nice to meet you. I can't stay, I'm actually feeling very sick. I kind of went home, just cried all the way home.
So there's a cost, obviously.
There is a cost, but I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't have not done Terminus, you know.
So when you get a script now, are you thinking ahead to what's this going to do to me? If I do this to the best of my ability, it's going to destroy me, you know?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think it has to be part of it, or there has to be a reason why you're doing it.
Mm.
I will have it cost me, but I will have it cost me because I know I've got Marty next to me. I know it's in a beautiful venue. I know it's for a short time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And actually, there's a lovely catharsis in it, you know.
Not just for the audience, but for you as
yeah.
well, for the performer.
Yeah.
Your next choice is The Clash, Police and Thieves. Police and Thieves, that's The Clash. My guest tonight is Eileen Walsh. Eileen's picking all the music tonight. We'll be back right after this break. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. We always get someone in to pick the music on Sunday, and tonight it's Eileen Walsh, one of our finest actors. And we've been just before the break, if you just joined us, Eileen was talking about how scary it can be and how that has affected her over the years. But I'm just looking down the list, Eileen. We printed out a little list of some of your theatre performances.
Right.
You know, National Theatre Scotland, Corka Dorka, obviously. But, you know, Abbey Theatre, Royal Court, Rough Magic, Liverpool Play. These are all big places, you know. And, you know, the Almeida Theatre, very famous theatres. Mm. Donmar Warehouse, the National Theatre. This is the London one, obviously. That's what I was looking for. Terminus went to New York, didn't it?
Yeah.
So how was that, suddenly in the Public Theatre in New York?
Yeah, it was really, really incredible. It was a beautiful time to get to be there with such an incredible play. But it was very nervy for me. So my whole day, sometimes when you're touring, people can think, oh, it's great, it's very exciting, look at you. Yeah. But actually your day is surrounded, you know, is built around the play.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure people do go out and get trashed or whatever because you've got hours to recover, that's fine. But actually, if you're building up towards doing something like Terminus, you've got to mind yourself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can do a little bit of sightseeing or, but not really a huge amount.
And it's, you know, it's hanging over you in a sense that every this is coming later in the evening.
Yeah.
Yeah. And presumably matinees as well in America, don't they? They tend to do that.
Yeah, I think there was a Sunday matinee, yeah. You know, that kind of American thing. But, yeah, and also it was part of a festival, so you were kind of there to work, to kind of squeeze as many shows in as possible. And you know, and it's New York, man. You wanna do yourself proud.
You're in the middle of it now. Again, in terms of the type of play, you mentioned Terminus, for instance, which is one kind of thing. But you've also, I mean, I saw you in the Abbey, in the Plough and the Stars,
yeah.
And you played Bessie Burgess.
Yeah.
How do you feel about different types of play? That's, you know, I know Mark's plays are now in the canon as well, but something like the Plough and the Stars, you know, it's one of those plays.
Yeah.
You know, has to be done.
So. I got offered Plough and the Stars and I was so unsure as to whether I'd take it because I would have loved to have played Nora.
Oh.
And I thought, oh no, I'm too old for Nora. That's such a shame, such a beautiful part. And Catherine, my sister, went, oh my God, do not be so stupid. Because I'd never seen Plough. She's like, Bessie is the role. Don't you dare turn it down. So I was like, oh, jeez, I better play it. I will then. Okay, grand. So I took it without actually appreciating what it was. And I was about a week into rehearsals. And I said to Catherine, you have to meet me. I have to work. Oh, my God, you have to meet me. And I remember sitting and going for a pint with her or whatever and going, I'm so glad you talked me into this. It's the most amazing role. So sometimes the blindness is quite a good thing. Just go in.
But when you come out of something like Disco Pigs and so on.
Yeah.
Was there any resistance in you to doing like old fashioned plays, if you know what I mean? I use that term. No, I know they're brilliant plays, but if you know what I mean from another, you know, you were doing this kind of cutting edge stuff that was cool.
I suppose it's interesting when you have to go back and do an old style. Whereas I think with Sean Holmes's production, because it was very modern, so it felt like it was about shaking off the oldness and making it relevant. And I think that's something that I enjoy doing, and the shock of owning something. So I love doing new plays. I love the fact of putting your stamp on it, and there's a beautiful feeling to getting the original playbook sent to you with you on the cast list, original. Yeah. Like that's a real buzz for an actor. But actually, getting to play something and put a twist on it, or receive it differently to anybody else. Which is, you know, obviously going to happen because you're fresh voice to it, is an amazing thrill, you know.
And have you done Shakespeare? Have you done Beckett? Have you done some of those? And if not, would that be through your own decision, your own choice not to go there?
I've played Ariel in The Tempest. Mm-hmm. I've done Merchant of Venice with Corcadorca. And I feel like I've done another Shakespeare. Oh, yeah, I did Hamlet with Michael Sheen. I played Rosencrantz at the Young Vic. And again, that was thrilling because suddenly Rosencrantz is female.
Yeah.
And Rosencrantz says, I once did love you. And that changes Hamlet for me, for playing, you know, it might be a small part, but wonderful actor called Adil Akhtar. Do you know Adil? He was in Four Lions as well.
Right.
He's an amazing actor. So he and I were Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And working with Michael was amazing.
Yeah, that was well reviewed, that, wasn't it, Michael Sheen's?
Yeah, he was wonderful. I think it was slightly style over substance, maybe. But yeah. You know, sometimes when they try to shoehorn an idea too much, but it was an incredible thing to be part of. So yeah, I mean, I love getting to do it. I've never done Beckett, and I'd love an old shot off Happy Days.
Yeah. You'd be the one.
I'd love a shot off Happy Days.
That would work.
Yeah.
Again, if
come
I
on, John, let's you and me. Let's do it.
That's
you lie behind me now in the chair.
Let's do it indeed. Yeah, no, that would definitely work.
Yeah.
Yeah. If anybody's listening, if anybody's
the
listening.
Hines.
the Hines. If the Hines is listening, that was my idea. Now, let's have your next musical choice, Eileen, which is, The Proclaimers, is it?
Proclaimers.
And you've picked a song. It's not the obvious one.
No.
Or the obvious few.
Yeah.
They're great songs, aren't they?
Oh, you know? Man, I love their writing.
Yeah.
I love their new album, The Bicycle, whatever it's called.
And
it's
your partner is
my fellow Scottish
as well. Yeah.
And for his parents' 50th wedding anniversary, they formed their own band, and himself and his brother and their mates, and they did songs about being 50 years married. But his dad's called Harry, so they did Hurry Up Harry, Come On, Come On, Come On. And then they did this for their mum, Jean.
And that's the Proclaimers there, a song called Oh Jean, the choice of Eileen Walsh, who's with me in the studio. I mean, we should mention before we leave the theatre, the while you're back in town, basically, is a play called Beginning. David Eldridge wrote that, and the previews begin this Thursday.
That's right.
Yeah. And what's it like just a few days before a production? What sort of mood are you in? You seem perfectly fine, but like, what happens?
It's exciting, and the anticipation is very palpable. We're running the show, so that's good. It's up and running and working through notes and finding little nuances.
Mm.
So it's a nice place to be in.
Yeah.
But also we're very safe because we're still in the rehearsal room. You know, it's just creeping into tech. So we'll start to take over the, as Katie Mitchell calls it, the bigger room.
Well,
so you don't get intimidated by calling it the theatre.
The publicity shot is yourself and Marty Ray, your co-star.
Yes.
And the both of you are laughing, smiling.
Yeah.
Is this a happy piece?
It's funny and charming and romantic and...
Ah, here.
Yeah. It's good. It's
no,
really
no bleeding
good.
Into the piano in this
No,
one.
There's a little... Of course there is. If I'm doing it, there's a little bit of bleeding into the piano, even when it's funny.
No tears and snot, though. And so tell me what you prepared to tell me about the play at this stage, you know?
So the play opens and it's... I've had a housewarming party.
Yeah.
And Marty's character, Danny, has been told to stay behind. So the play opens with two grown-ups left at the end of the party.
Who told him to stay behind?
His friends.
Right.
Kind of said, you're in. You're in there.
Okay.
Nice work.
Right.
Because that's what men do around me. That kind of sound. Great. Yeah. And it's about... She would really like to have a baby.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And... I think she's just looking for a one-night stand, and then she's got everything she needs, but she'd love a baby. So, yeah, let's have, you know...
And he is the anointed one.
Yeah, but then the stars align in the sense that it's not... Maybe it's not just going to be a one-night stand. Sometimes you have to take a leap of faith.
Okay.
It's very beautiful.
Okay. Sounds like a movie to me.
That could
be a movie.
Well, it's so... Because it's all set in one room, you know.
There we are. Beginning, and the Irish premiere coming up at the Gate Theatre, and well, all the best with that. The preview starting Thursday night, so
yeah.
And you've got a good co-star there, Marty Ray.
Oh, I love him.
He's very, very good and very funny.
It's easy to be on stage.
Very,
with him.
Very funny.
Yeah, very tall.
That's always a good start. Well, let's talk about the movies then, because I'm thinking of Eden, and. You know, Children's Act, various things that you've been in. How do you treat movies as a kind of an extra thing to your working life?
Well, I love actors who say,
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I only do films. I think, dear God bless you. That is a fabulous thing that you've been able to decide to do in your life. I am lucky that I get to do some films and some telly, you know. But theatre is my constant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that I know well, you know, please God, you know, just be there. And then with relationships, like actually working with Richard Eyre, he was my first time at the National.
Right.
And then Richard came back and said, come and play the Almeida.
Yeah.
And then Richard came back and said, come and do the Children Act.
Right. So it's not necessarily as though you're joining another tribe to go and make a movie. It's often sometimes the same people.
No, I'm so kind of lucky to get to do that. And then I met Sharon Horgan on Twitter. I asked her to come and see a play at the Royal Court that I was doing. And she said, yeah, definitely. And then she, being of the telly world, couldn't make it to the play that particular night, but the following week asked me to come in and audition for Catastrophe.
Well, let's park Catastrophe for a moment. I want to talk about TV separately in a minute, but in terms of the movies, and I understand about not being able to necessarily be able to make choices about these things, but if a movie comes along, do you approach it differently? Do you just think, well, look, this is a movie, I've got a part in it, I turn up, I do my gig and I go home? Is it a slightly different approach?
Yeah. If it's something like Magdalene Sisters, if it's something like Eden, then you work with the director. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of, you, they will set aside a rehearsal time. But really, it's all off your own back, you know. So the amount of research you do is up to you. And there's, it will be awful to turn up on the day and not have as much done as the lighting rigger, you know. Yeah.
Well, of course, a film like Eden, you know, obviously it was very important that you're fully engaged with that, because that was you.
Yeah. You know, Catherine played that originally on stage.
On stage, did your sister?
Yeah.
Wow. And then when you think of Magdalene Sisters as well, you know, that was, I mean, that's, you know, I know you're in it a lot, but one of the most memorable scenes in Irish cinema, I think, you know. And it's not the slightly comedic part where the priest runs off. It's the state of you.
Yeah.
It's just harrowing.
I feel, I know it's one of those things, I mean, I hate it when I hear myself say it, because like part of me goes, you don't really mean that. But if I were to never play another part in a film, to have played that role at that time, the beginning of all that with the Ryan Report coming out, it's an incredible part of history to be part of. And I still have people come up to me and go, you're the girl who was, you're not a man of God girl, is what I actually want to get. But they will then tell you their history. Their mum was in, or, you know, it's amazing. It's an amazing connector of people.
Yeah. It's still tough to watch, because I saw it again recently, actually. It's very, very tough to watch.
Yeah. I think Peter Mullen did an amazing job on it.
And I know that it does, you know, that scene ends up in a slightly comedic kind of scene of the priest running off and all of that, but I'm afraid I'm still stuck back at the previous part, you know, with you there. So it's amazing. And you know, if you never did movies, would it bother you? I mean, is that
oh, look, it's, you know, lovely to be on set.
Yeah,
it's lovely to have the research done and to feel like you can lose yourself in something, and it's lovely to get a couple of goes to get it right.
Yeah.
Do you know, though, it is. Yeah. It's a very different thing. And actually, the respect that you're shown is incredible, because people know that if it's an intense scene, move back, give her the space. So that, because normally the lighting guys, the sound guys, the camera guys, everybody gets their shot. And then the actors are kind of thrown in and told, come on, we've only got 5 minutes. Whereas when it's an important scene, they really allow you the space. And that's a lovely thing to be given. Whereas I guess sometimes in theatre, the nice thing is that you get to show up every night and do it better. Go again. So it's nice on film that you only have to bleed into the piano once.
Next choice, musically speaking, is what?
Oh, I Now Do.
Yeah. Tell me about this, because he's a sort of a staple on Lyric, this
I Now Do
guy. Yeah.
Yeah, of course he is, because all his work sounds like a movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
I've worked with a company called Frantic Assembly, and they do a lot of movement, and they're an amazing company. And then Stephen Hoggett used to be part of them, and now he's a choreographer in his own right, and did a lot of the Harry Potters and Rocky on Broadway and stuff. Anyway, I worked with Stephen recently, and he has you choreograph before you know it. You're making it. And he tells you to move, you and your partner's hands, you move three times and then you move another three times and slowly you set up 12. And then he comes around and says, now make that 12 into a circle, keep going, keep going. And then he whispers a little thing in your ear and says something like, do it again, now think betrayal or think honesty or think just a word. And then he plays this track and then you create this amazing piece that can be incredibly sad or incredibly joyful. And the Ein Audi music it tends to be very much used within it to create. So that's what it says to me.
Wow. Eileen Walsh is my guest tonight. Eileen's picking all the music, and that's music by Ein Audi. And she was just describing before that, or you were, Eileen. Good night, Irene. Good night.
Thanks, Sean.
And Eileen was describing earlier on how that was used in a kind of an exercise. Mm. And that what you were talking about, this idea of actors trusting each other in a performance, particularly if it's a love relationship, mm-hmm. as in this play you're doing with Marty. Mm. Tell me a bit more about that idea of trust, because if you are staring intimately into somebody's eyes and holding their hands and, you know, doing all this kind of motion together and music's happening and all that sort of stuff, there have to be boundaries.
Yeah.
And yet you can't be thinking about those boundaries.
No, because as soon as you consider any boundaries, the audience reads that. There'll be a prickling thing that happens, that somebody will pull back or feel like, oh, I didn't mean that to happen. So there has to be an atmosphere where it is safe, but is allowed. And so I think that's something that Marty and I definitely have, because we've worked together a few times before. Also, you have to allow yourself to fall in love for that hour and a half every night.
Yeah, well, tell me more about that, because that's risky.
Yeah. Well, it's only risky if your relationship is risky. Your personal relationship, I mean.
Yeah.
But actually, if you're both secure, loads of people have affairs. Loads of people, do fall in love, and other people, do have relationships that spark out of that, But you can't be doing that all the time. You'd be falling in love left, right, and center.
Yeah. But even in the exercise that you're talking about, you could, in a sense, not in a real sense, or possibly a real sense, fall in love with somebody for 30 seconds.
I'm not kidding you. I fell in love and lived a brief moment with that Hannes was his name. Beautiful, beautiful dancer. Amazing guy.
How long were you in love with him for?
I was in love with him for about, say, 3 minutes.
It's not a bad...
It's glorious, John. It was glorious. He was a dancer. It was amazing.
It's not a bad deal.
No, but also, that's what it is. It's risky and it's dangerous. And when it's risky and dangerous, I think that's when it's great art. It can be, because you're experiencing something that somebody's letting you in on.
Yeah.
And it's a free fall.
Yeah, but what about... I know what you're talking about, because I know actors. But, if I didn't know actors, I'd be inclined to say, well, what about pretending? Isn't that what you're supposed to be doing? Aren't you supposed to pretend that you're in love with that person?
Yeah, but when you were a kid, right, and you played... doctors or, I'm not like sexually, I didn't mean that, whatever you were, a fireman or something. Again, not sexual.
Let's stick with...
Jesus.
Fireman?
God, what did you pretend to be? But like, you know...
Cowboys and Indians,
thank you. You remember that, don't you?
Yeah,
you remember the need to, send a smoke signal, and it's that intensity, it's just that you're adults now doing it.
Mm.
I can't explain it any more than that. But if I don't fall completely in love with Marty, then I haven't done my job.
Right.
Because the story is that. And there's nothing I love more than watching Meryl Streep, stroke somebody's face and hold them. And you can see that moment of connection happen. And if you're holding back, you're just building a wall. You're protecting yourself from something.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's nothing to see then. There's no story to tell then.
And the trust factor between the two actors, I suppose, means that neither of you have to be conscious of the boundaries because you trust each other.
Yeah.
Not to cross them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've also done shows, though, where not love stories, but where actors haven't been so mindful and have used lines to spit at actors.
Really?
And that's shocking because you just go, ah, that's now, you know, bullish behaviour because people are getting laugh lines. And that's worrying because then you go, lads, it's just a job. I just want to turn up and do the job.
And
that's tricky.
Are actors, and I'm thinking particularly women, are they minded a lot more now than they would have been in these intimate situations in rehearsal and on stage?
Yeah, so there's a big push from America now. America has started to bring in intimacy directors, and we're only ever 6 months behind, particularly, I guess, you know, like the National Theatre in London. I know that they've started to bring in intimacy directors. And then even for us today, we had the lovely David Bolger in because there's a little bit of intimacy involved in our play too. And David came in to oversee and to make sure that we were okay with what was happening and mm-hmm. everyone was comfortable. And, you know, and it's nice, actually. It's really good to have a little check-in. So that creatively it looks good.
Yeah.
And then that nobody is feeling, I don't know, actually, if given the option, I might just not, you know, take that off, or I might. So it's good to make sure that everyone's okay with it because it is a new era.
Yeah.
You know.
And in terms of the person who's making the creative suggestions, does that make it easier then for that person too? Who with absolutely the right motive might say, well, we need a bit of nudity for this scene, or we don't. You know, those sorts of decisions that it takes it away from the possibility even that that decision has been taken just for the sake of it.
Yeah, well, I guess that's really important to get all that clear before you take the job.
Yeah.
As to how much, because sometimes that can be sprung, not so much now, before, sprung on you. I did a job where I was asked to maybe remove my bra, a stage play. And I remember thinking, well, nobody's actually going to know whether I have a bra on or not. So that's not important, I don't see. But then I suddenly thought, but you'd know.
Yeah.
That's, and so you could come and watch the play that you've directed. And that was weird.
Yeah.
That was weird, you know.
But you're saying there's less of that now.
Yeah, definitely. Also, girls, young girls feel more empowered to say no.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Next choice is Mary Black.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, Mary Black is lovely and has a lovely voice and everything. This song reminds me of crying in bed on a Sunday night listening to Cork 100 Love Songs, thinking, school in the morning.
Okay.
I found your letter in my mailbox.
So, Eileen Walsh, your school's the next morning, you're sitting
Jesus,
up in bed
bawling, John, bawling.
And you're crying your eyes out listening to Mary Black.
Yeah, because I had to go to bed early, obviously, being the youngest of six.
Yeah.
They were left to stay
up. I'm surprised
they
even knew you were there.
Well, they didn't really, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
And what were you crying about?
Oh, God, I hated school. And I wanted to be downstairs with my sisters and my brother. I didn't want to be upstairs with the picture of the Virgin Mary over the bed. Oh, and Mary Black on the radio.
What was the station? Cork what?
Cork 100 Love Songs.
Great. If I can find that on the way home, I'll be listening to it myself. And so we're just looking at the time we have. Now, let's talk about television.
Okay.
We've talked about the movies and we talked about the theatre and we talked about all sorts of stuff and I appreciate it.
Mm.
But let's talk about TV. You mentioned Sharon Horgan earlier.
Yeah.
And you said you met her on Twitter.
Yeah, we followed each other on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I loved her show Dead Boss. I'd never seen Pulling. Which is the one everyone talks about.
Yeah.
But I loved Dead Boss. I found it hilarious. And I thought she was very funny on Twitter as well. And I was doing a show at the Royal Court called Internet is Serious Business, all about the hackers who took down PayPal, Anonymous and Lulzac, they were called. Anyway, so I said, I'd love you to come and see me in it. But yes, that started our friendship, actually. And then I had to go in and audition for Catastrophe. And then go back and do a chemistry meet. Now, normally you only have to do a chemistry meet if you're, you know, the love interest in the film or the telly thing.
Let's explain. What is a chemistry meet?
So, say you're playing the lead, John, and I'm desperately in love with you.
Yeah.
They would set up a camera and they would kind of need us to work through a scene and make sure that there's a hot right now kind of vibe.
So,
yeah.
But that's surely, how does that work? Because people would surely...
Jesus Christ, you can find anybody attractive. Yeah, you just do it. That's your job.
But would people not feign chemistry then? Would
yes.
act chemistry?
So you can feign it, but then it's... when it does happen, there's an amazing ignition.
Right.
You know? So I guess they're waiting on that lucky thing. But anyway, it's really unusual to do it as a girlfriend thing.
All right, yeah.
So I had to seem like, you know, one of her best buds.
So really what would happen, you would leave the room and then another actor would come in to see if that actor has chemistry?
Yeah.
And then another one?
Yeah.
That's weird.
But particularly weird for the person who's left in the room. So,
yeah.
You know, they're only ever casting one person.
Yeah.
Normally the guy is cast first.
Yeah.
And so you've got a trail of young women coming in to flirt with you, basically, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's pretty exhausting for the guy as well. God, I love him. But, you know, trying to make this chemistry all the time as well. But anyway, Sharon and Rob were there for the chemistry meet and we just got on like a house on fire and just laughed for about 40 minutes.
So, in a sense, what she was looking for was someone with whom she had chemistry, basically.
Yes, who would be an ease.
That was the that's all that was required for the you know, not all that was required, but that's
bit
what
of acting too, John. Thanks.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's what she was after. That's what she was looking for.
Yeah, she's a very, very clever woman.
And having someone like Sharon deeply involved in the production, I'm sure that removes a lot of the issues that might have been problematic for women in you know,
they're all gone. She's a powerhouse because she has ownership of everything. Her and Rob obviously write it together, and they were there for every scene, every day, every take. But Sharon, kind of co-directs, really.
Yeah.
She'll come down and she'll tell you, you know, you were funnier in the last take. Do the line that way. But the second half of the scene, you were funnier. You know, she remembers exactly and tries to pinpoint where you... And you can't question it because she knows comedy like nobody. She is amazing. But she will have a say over your costume. She gets everything down to a fine point. And it works, you know.
And what about you in comedy? Because I think of some of the parts that I haven't seen you in everything because a lot of your performances have been in England. But the ones I've seen here, they weren't a barrel of laughs, a lot of the things you were in.
No, I mean, I'm so lucky that somebody like Sharon kind of fights my corner. So I get to do a lot of comedy.
Yeah.
Telly-wise,
yeah,
you know, and that's great. What a balance! It's a lovely balance, you know.
And telly's a strange one too, because I'm just thinking of people who've been on this show, like your friend Killian, and so on.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't matter what you do on the stage; you're on the television for 10 minutes, and everybody knows you.
Yeah,
it must change the dynamic for you.
It does change a bit, but then again, I mean, I think it's different for Killian. I mean, he's so goddamn handsome, and. You know, and then he plays such cool guys.
I can't say too. I noticed.
Yeah. But, you know, so I can, like, it's tricky for him. I, you know, tend to play maybe an idiot or a horny idiot. It's kind of those two. So I don't really get too much hassle from people. They either go, she God, love her, or, yeah, she's all right.
You know. Anybody advertising themselves as a horny idiot is definitely going to get attention. and of course Sharon's done so well. I mean, it's several things.
I mean, her company, Merman, are amazing. And I always, for me, she is a woman who, you know that description of somebody who puts the ladder down?
Yeah.
Sharon keeps putting the ladder down. She's like pulling people up all the time.
So is television, you know, is television a pleasure? Because, you know, there's that thing about TV, particularly in Britain, where you kind of, and you live there, that sense of, you know, being part of the furniture in people's houses all the time, you know, on the screen in the corner of the telly, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about that for an actor, I think.
Yeah, it's lovely, you know, and it's lovely to be considered for other things because they've seen you in, like, actually, because Catastrophe did so well, then the lovely, amazing casting agent, Nina Gold, then put me into this thing called Patrick Melrose that was with Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
But but it was, you know, a funny role within this very dark piece. And so you go, oh, God, that's great. It's lovely to be able to kind of sideline into things like that. So, I think the community of TV tends to, I don't know, help spread you into other things.
And when you're working on a TV programme like that, do you have any idea what the bigger picture is? Do you know what's going on beyond your own scenes and what's coming down the tracks? Or does
well, so
it
you
matter?
Do a big read through a couple of weeks beforehand. Something like Catastrophe is amazing because they do this massive read through and get as many people as they can to turn up for it. Something like Melrose, we did a huge read through and there were so many big names there. It was terrifying. And that was incredible. And then, but, you know, we didn't know Catastrophe was going to be as big as it was, but because it was hilarious. And normally if something is so funny in the read through, that will never transfer. But it did. And then it became like a little football team because Ben Taylor, who directed it, directed all three seasons. He just wasn't available for the last one. He used to refer to us all by our surnames. So he would go, all right, Walsh, do that dance you do. And you go, oh, I didn't even know I had a dance. I guess there. And so there was a brilliant kind of camaraderie with it.
Yeah. And in those big read-throughs, you mentioned Melrose, which is Cumberbatch, and a lot of other people too.
Oh my God.
And it was a fairly spectacular kind of thing.
Well, they asked me to fill in and read a couple of other roles. And I suddenly looked across and I was reading opposite Jennifer Jason Leigh. Oh my God. It was incredible. Lovely thing to be part of. And it filmed in the south of France. It was like a jammy job.
But again, as you say at the start, you can't be sitting there thinking this is Jennifer Jason Leigh. You just have to do your thing.
Yeah, stop looking at her. I was a bit like, oh my God, oh, sorry, I have lines.
Your next choice, and we're going to have to start cutting back here on your list because we're running out of time.
Grant.
Okay, well, speaking of television, we're about to have an Alan Partridge moment now because I noticed that your next choice is the Waltons.
I know. So, right, I spoke earlier about my dad. My dad loved Galty Mountain Boy. My dad died nearly 3.5, 4 years ago now. And it was very unexpected. And he was, I mean, he's a massive loss to us. But my sister, in organising the funeral, had asked all his bowling, you know, road bowling?
Road bowls, yeah.
Yeah, right. So my dad loved playing that. And she asked some of the men to come and carry the coffin. And they were like, oh, we're just too old. We can't. So, of course, we understood that. She had this boy called Joseph Toomey, I wrote his name down on my hand, who was a student from the school she teaches in Spridnave, and he came and played Galty Mountain Boy as my dad was carried out, and all the bowlers surprised us and they were all lined up outside with their black armbands on.
Oh, lovely.
And it was it was incredibly beautiful, and a lovely honour to my dad. So this song's for my dad.
Eileen Walsh in studio with me tonight, picking the music. She wanted that one played for her dad, and that's Galty Mountain Boy. We'll have time for one more, Eileen, but before you go, Thursday night, the previews begin for David Eldridge at the Gate. I want to wish you and Marty well with that one.
Thank you so much.
And Eileen, thanks for coming in. It was a real pleasure.
Cheers.
You went
thanks.
Deep there on the acting, so I appreciate
I'm sorry
it.
Sorry about that.
No, but I appreciate it. It's good. It's good of you. It's good of you to give us your time and your experience.
Well, this one is for Marty. This is the song I think of when I go to work to rehearse with him.
Eileen Walsh, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.